diagram that right now is kind of out there in the therapy literature that many therapists are starting to use. You can actually break this into about 10 different domains to keep things simple. I'm using kind of the big five here. So let's, you know, define what these are going to look like and then look at what this looks like in kids today. So the first thing we need to remember is that all of us, every single one of us, have these type of components within our brain functioning, okay? All of us develop language, we have motor skills, executive function, and we all fluctuate on what that looks like. And conceptually, the idea is if I'm closer to the middle of the circle, my skills are less developed, and if my skills are more developed, they move towards the outer rings. And the reality is we fluctuate in and out, depending on if we're tired today or we have different stressors in our life. And some of us have stronger areas within each of these sensory components and brain functions, and some of us have weaker components. And so it's all a matter of finding that balance and how does this all mesh with our learning. So let's talk about what each of these is. So first of all, language is defined basically as how we as human beings communicate. It is much more than just the structure and the conversation that we use with language and writing, but it's also all those Hello? If you wouldn't mind my muting yourself, that would be great. it's also all that nonverbal communication, which is actually one of the areas where many of these children will struggle. The language and stuff, they'll take very literal as far as the communication they hear or maybe what they write, but gestures and facial expressions can be really, really difficult for them to process. The next area is motor skills, and this basically refers to the acquiring and refinement of how we move through space. How do I move up and down? How do I go from here to there? And, you know, if we really think about children today, the best way that all of us have done this is through natural play. Just getting out there and using our bodies and seeing something fascinating and wanting to get up there and play in it. And oftentimes, especially in littler kids, we see a lot of this kind of tongue action that this little guy's got going on too, as we're climbing through different things and working on motor skills. Sensory systems, these are how our nervous system takes in the different information of our world, so not just the basic five that we learn in school as far as sight and touch and hearing and taste and smell, but also what's called the two interior senses, the vestibular sense and the proprioceptive sense, which give us a sense of where our body is in space and how we're using our muscles. And we'll get more into these a little bit later as well. Perception then is the process of what our brain does both consciously and unconsciously to take in all this information that it's getting, especially when we're very little, and organizing it and interpreting it to understand what the world means. So the more sensory information that comes into our brain, the more we can organize it and begin to understand what we can and cannot do in the world. And so we're constantly making new connections. This is kind of the brain taking a lot of that initial data and then building it and manipulating it and understanding the complexities of the world. And then executive function, and this is going to be just a real light touch on executive function. You could take day-long workshops on this, but executive function is really the mental process that our brain goes through that helps us to plan and focus and pay attention and remember and juggle tasks. The area of the brain that does a lot of this is our frontal lobe, and this is functioning and connections that take many, many years for the brain to organize. So developmentally, we know that the frontal cortex develops well into our 20s and 30s, and so some of the things you're going to see happen under executive function are things like impulse control. Can I think before I act? Having emotional control. Can I keep my feelings in check when I get overwhelmed? Do I have flexibility of thinking? Can I adjust my behavior when things don't go quite the way I expect? Something like working memory, so that ability to hold information in my brain that's really important to complete a task. So Can I remember the directions of what I'm supposed to do with these math problems and do the whole page? Or do I have to go back and read the directions over and over and over every time I see a problem? The ability to self-monitor, to be aware of who I am and how I'm feeling in that moment. And, you know, do I feel good about where I am right now? Or am I struggling? The ability to plan and prioritize, so to be able to set and meet goals. The ability to actually initiate the task. So, okay, maybe I've created a plan, but can I actually initiate that plan, or do I kind of get stuck in the process of getting it going? And then another characteristic would be able to organize, organizing my world physically and mentally. Can I plan how I want to do things and organize that in a way that's going to allow me to be successful? So these are some of the things that fall under executive function. A lot of stuff that obviously is tapped into the school day, but a lot of this actually develops just while children are playing too, and as they're developing. So those are the five quadrants. So what I want to do is start kind of with a typical eight-year-old. And, you know, it's important to remember that every child is unique and every individual is unique. So how this chart is going to, or actually this pie chart is going to look for you is going to be unique to you. But if we think about it and kind of look at what we would think as typical, this is what we would see for language development for an eight-year-old. Their language is fairly sophisticated. They may be reading at this point, definitely writing, and able to verbalize what they like and don't like and tell you all kinds of stories. And, you know, their language is pretty good from the standpoint of also nonverbal language, being able to understand when somebody's kidding with them or joking or angry or upset just by looking at facial responses. Their motor skills are pretty developed, both the gross motor and fine motor, so they're able to maneuver through their world quite successfully. They're able to work on writing and coloring and drawing. Their sensory systems have all come online quite well and are getting integrated perceptually, so they're taking a lot of information that they've learned in their eight little years of life and are making some pretty accurate predictions about how the world's going to work, or are able to tell you about different pieces of information that they've learned and how to put those things together. And their executive functioning skills are all coming online as well. So as they go through their school day, they're learning to organize and plan. And as the day goes on, their executive functioning may drop off a bit as they get tired. But all these things are coming online for the most part. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave kind of this kiddo in the background, and we're going to look at some of these different diagnoses that you guys brought up when I asked you about kids today. So the first one that came up was autism. And so autism is really defined as a developmental neurological disorder that has extreme impact on communication. So we see a huge deficit here with language communication, both verbally and non-verbally. The research shows that their motor skills are delayed compared to their typical peers. Some may have pretty good motor, gross motor skills, but not good fine motor skills. It may be deficits across the board. It really is variable. Their sensory systems also may be a little slower on coming online. They may have one or two that are very hyper accurate, and others that are under responsive. The interesting thing with a lot of these kiddos on the spectrum is their perceptions, that the information that they are able to pull in, they're able to really pinpoint how to use it. So oftentimes, if we're looking at some of the work of Temple Grandin, she will talk about that oftentimes people with autism have special interests, where they can be very high-tuned and highly focused on specific topics of information, and those are tied to this perception piece. And then their executive function is typically delayed. They need some of those supports to help them organize their world, and some of their emotional outbursts may be impacted by that inability to self-monitor and to keep themselves kind of in check from an emotion standpoint too. Another diagnosis that I don't think any of you mentioned, but is similar to autism, but with one significant difference. is sensory processing disorder. And this is another developmental neurological disorder. The big difference here is these children are also often very verbal. They are usually able to tell you exactly what they need and don't need. What's happening is that their sensory systems are receiving messages that can impact their behavior and their motor skills. So we do see deficits in some of their motor planning and their ability to execute their plans. Their sensory systems are usually, again, impacted either by hypersensitivity or undersensitivity. Their perceptions, which are different from autism, are impacted because the information they're getting from their sensory system isn't accurate. And so then their body is responding to inaccurate information. So if they're getting touched by something that feels threatening, then their response is to react in a threatening behavior, a protective behavior. So they might even go into a fight or flight response as part of that sensation that feels scary to their body. And then their executive functioning is also impacted. So that ability, especially for emotional regulation and being able to have that self-awareness of how to calm themselves when they get overwhelmed, can really impact their ability to engage day in and day out, and especially with their peers. One diagnosis that you all brought up, or so quite a few have brought up, was ADHD. So again, this is another, you know, brain disorder or neurological disorder, and it affects that ability to pay attention, sit still, and control one's behaviors. This is a diagnosis. Actually, all of these diagnoses continue into teenage years and adulthood. And so, you know, part of what the strategies are that we teach all these individuals as therapists are how to adjust to situations or prepare themselves for situations. Again, this is a group that often is quite verbal. They're able to tell you kind of what they like, what they don't like. Sometimes their ability to control their language when they're really excited about something is hard. So they tend to really just jabber on and on and on about their topic of interest and whatever is fascinating them at the moment. The research does show that quite a few of them do have motor skill impact as part of their diagnosis, as well as some sensory delays. So we do see an overlap between sensory processing disorder and ADHD. There's about 40% of kids with ADHD do have some type of sensory diagnosis as well. This again impacts their perception and their ability to accurately combine sensory information to predict what their world is going to be like. And probably their biggest deficit in this whole area is within that executive functioning part of the puzzle. That ability to pay attention, to sit still, to control their behavior is where they really struggle the most. And then another diagnosis that I have in here that I don't believe I saw on the list, but it could have been there, is dyslexia. And this is, again, a diagnosis that is a learning disorder. It does affect their ability to read and spell and write and speak. And depending also on how it expresses itself, it can also impact their ability to do mathematics, which is dyscalculia. Or they can have the ability, a disability that impacts their ability to understand spatial relations, which is dysgraphia. So those are all tied in with this dyslexia diagnosis. And so what we see there is definitely language deficits, but different from those with those kids with autism. These children often are verbal, but struggle with how letters are oriented, orders of letters, how to spell, impacts their reading, and then also can have a motor component, and it impacts some of their abilities, again, to speak and articulate what they want to say. And so they have to think really hard to be able to connect the letters and make the sounds they want to make. Research does show that, again, there's some sensory components to this diagnosis. Their perceptions, though, unlike our kiddos who have ADHD, are more accurate with understanding the sensory information that they are getting accurately. And then their executive function again is impacted because again they have to go back to reread the directions. Their self-concept is tied into that, and so that does affect their self-awareness. So we can see that all of these diagnoses have blends of deficits in all five of these parts of the chart. Some statistics just from the Canadian side. This is from the most current study of the Canadian Health Survey of Children from 2019, is 1 in 50 Canadian children and youth from the ages of 1 to 17 are diagnosed with some type of autism spectrum disorder. So that may be anything from Asperger's to very clear autistic type diagnoses. As far as sensory processing disorder, I know it's a diagnosis that Canadians deal with because I have a bunch of OT friends up there who work with these kiddos. Disability Credit Canada does have this particular statement that they've put is that it's not recognized as a standalone diagnosis, but it is often related to other conditions, autism, Down syndrome, mental retardation, as well as ADHD. So I think, like the U.S., it's not often, again, acknowledged, at least from a funding medical reimbursement standpoint, as a standalone diagnosis, but it does get lumped in again with multiple other diagnoses. When we look at the data around ADHD in Canada, it is one of the most common neurodevelopmental disorders in Canada. And again, this is a diagnosis that doesn't just go away when you turn 18, but it does affect adults as well as children. And roughly 1 in 21 people have the disorder across the country. And then when we look at dyslexia, 1 in 5 have dyslexia, and about 40% of children in Canada with learning disability experiences experience this as part of their mental health diagnoses. So that's again a good volume of kiddos. And so one of the reasons we bring these statistics to the forefront is, when we look at children with disabilities, these are all kids who look typical. They look just like their peers. There's really nothing. They're not using a mobility device. They're not using they don't have any typical or atypical facial features that may let you know that they have this condition that they're trying to work through. And so they look pretty typical. And so again, services are received through school supports, but we're not necessarily thinking about them when we're designing. And so the reality is, for a lot of these kids, they get overwhelmed when they get out in really busy spaces. And I love this image because it's the image is perfect. The kid is out of control. His shirt is like danger. Couldn't have set this up better if I wanted to. But that's what the world feels like for a lot of these kids, is that they feel that the world is dangerous and unsafe, and so they have a difficult time getting out there to really play and shine. And so really what we're going to do with the rest of this presentation is look at how can we change that? How can we think about them when we're designing to make sure that they get the supports that they need? So again, we're going to use this model of getting there. So these are going to be the concepts that are part of design and thinking even beyond the design, the broader park and supports for the park to help the family get there. What are the concepts that actually have to be built into the play environment to allow the children to play there and be successful? And then what are the things that we build into the design that allows the family to stay there and play there for a while? Okay, so let's get into how do we get there. Really, the first thing in this day and age is looking at your website. And then we go into parking and public transportation access. We need to think about what is our entry and how do we help people orient to the space coming in, and then what are signage and wayfinding opportunities. So let's start with the getting there. And I'm using the example of a playground that I worked on in Ohio, where they've done a really nice job of putting together on their website an understanding of what is their at this park. So how do I get there? What are my parking options? What hours do you operate? Are you open from dawn to dusk? Are there times of the day that are busy? So if you're a bigger park and you have field trips that come in, some park districts will actually put up a calendar showing when a larger groups of kids are coming. What are the features on the playground that allow people to play there? So getting into some of the different types of sensory experiences that might be there, play experiences. What are the elements that allow you to stay there? What are the amenities? What do those look like? Do they have all the features that I might need to be able to stay at the park for the day, like shade and tables? And we'll get into that. Include a map of the park and the playground. If it's a large park, where are those restrooms in the park? And then highlight any type of sensory programs or events that you might do. And this gives families right from the very beginning a sense of where are they going and how can they be successful there. One of the things you're going to notice in the top right corner on each of the slides is again that circle of our pie, and each of these strategies will be highlighted with a black dot as to what components do they help support for the family and the children who are coming to play. So you'll see that kind of on each slide. Other things with the website to think about, you know, research around designing for individuals on the autistic spectrum, as well as just children in general, is keep it simple. And there are definitely some infographics out there, as well as some websites that can give you some ideas around that. You may want to explore going into open fonts for those who have dyslexia. The open dyslexic font is one that I'm seeing more and more children's museums begin to use now, understanding that the research shows that these particular fonts actually are easier to read for those who have dyslexia. And then the other thing you want to think about is the language that you're using. You know, in the world today, we have individuals who are more focused on their disability as being part of their identity. So they see it as an identity first. So the autistic person would be an example of that. Others lean more towards person first language. So a person with autism would be an example of that. And this is a very personal choice for that person who has whatever that medical condition is as to how they want to identify themselves. And so what we recommend is that you blend that language on your website, that you have a little bit of both so people can kind of see and find their connection within your language. There are two groups in particular who tend to be more identity first, and that's the deaf community and the autism community. A lot of individuals with autism do prefer to be called an autistic person. By having both, you kind of meet everybody's needs and they're able to kind of see themselves within your materials that you might have online. If you do any type of program books, around recreation programs, things like that. Again, blend that language into that, as well as including imagery of individuals of varying abilities within whatever programming books you put together, and maybe even include some quotes from them if they're willing to share those about programs that you might have. When we think about parking, it's really important that we think about where is that, first of all, public transportation access. So here in this particular overhead, you can see that we've got several bus stops that are very close to the park. We've got a very clearly marked crosswalk, which actually has signals. You can't quite tell from overhead, but it really allows people to come from the community, which is down at the bottom of the image, as well as those who are coming from public transportation. Keep your inclusive or accessible parking close by. If you have a larger parking lot, consider having a drop-off area where, you know, if your accessible parking gets full, it's close to the playground, a family can come in and do drop-off and then move to a larger parking lot area that you might have around and the other areas of the park that give you that access. Really have those clear, defined pathways. Try to keep the parking as close to the playground as you can. And then if you're doing larger parking areas, think about where the plantings and the trees go so that they're not blocking line of sight for parents driving cars or people driving cars, because we all know, regardless of whether a child has autism or not, when they see the playground, they go for the playground and they're not necessarily paying attention to traffic. So we want to make sure that we keep that line of sight available to drivers and to kids so that everybody stays safe. When you think about your entry point, think about something that makes it fairly clearly defined. So if we look at the image on the left, which is a big playground in just out of Washington, D.C., it's based on the Wizard of Oz, so I guess they call it the Wizard of Oz Park. It's the Watkins Regional Park, but the rainbow is the main entry into the park area. And so, again, it allows families to gather at that entry point before everybody rushes in to go and play. Preston's Hope is another example where at their main entry they have a art piece that was created by a local artisan in memory of Preston. And again, integrated seats and such so that people can wait for those who are parking the cars and such to come so they can all enter the park together. When we're thinking about orienting, we want to think about pathways that give you a sense of where things are. This is Paco Sanchez Park, which is in Denver, Colorado. Paco Sanchez was a DJ, and so they wanted a structure that looked like a microphone. So that's what you see at kind of the top of the image there. And then they've used the concrete sidewalk to define the different areas of play as you work your way down the hill. The microphone climber, which has a spiral slide inside and all kinds of really cool things inside of it for kids to play in, provides the orientation. It's something that you can literally see from miles away. So there's parking up by the microphone, but there's also, this is a much broader park that connects all the way to downtown Denver, has multiple ball fields and performance areas. And so you can see this lower parking area. You can see as you work your way up the left there, there's different pods of play and opportunities for kids to enjoy and families to enjoy. And they've integrated this aerial map again into different areas of the park as well as to the website. And then because this park is so large, besides using kind of the lamppost signage, they've actually marked the actual sidewalks with which trails go different ways. So those are color-coded, what are ways to get to downtown, what are ways to get to public transportation, what are ways to get to other features within the park. So using that wayfinding. Wayfinding can also be done in tactile maps, and again here we want to make sure that we also are including some of those elements that are supporting those with visual impairments. A lot of our kids with sensory are still drawn to the different tactile elements that might be added if you do like a three-dimensional park design in particular. And then you can also be playful with your directions. So here again at the Wizard of Oz Park, we took advantage of the scarecrow trying to help people understand what is where on the playground and how to get to the Yellow Brick Road, which takes you back to the parking lot, and the Ruby Red's Shoes, which actually is one of the slides within it. So once we get there, we want to make sure that we're creating priority play experiences that families are going to really enjoy. And so I want to talk about a concept called sensory diversity, and I'll get into that in a minute. We're going to talk about some surfacing, some tactile play, some proprioceptive and vestibular play, and then finish off with auditory, visual, smell, and taste. So one of the things I hear a lot of today from designers, a lot of landscape architects, this is kind of the buzzword, is wanting to have sensory-rich play opportunities within a playground. And the feedback I get from a lot of families who have children with autism or on this autism spectrum say, it's too much. And so I'm proposing that we really look at what's called a more sensory diverse design. And the idea here goes back to really Jane Eyre's theory around sensory processing disorder, which is that children will seek what they need within sensory systems, and we need to provide that them in such a way that they have the diversity, but it's not overwhelming. And so we want to give them that chance of finding the just right fit. So we need to have things that move, we need to have things that spin, we need to have things that allow us to climb, we need to have things that allow us to use sight and taste and textures, but not in such a way that it's overwhelming to the nervous system. So it's finding a balance here. So I want to present this playground to you. So this is at the zoo in Winnipeg. And this is the same play feature. And if you look at these two, which one overwhelms you? The one on the left or the one on the right? You can either put that in the chat or open up your microphone and let me know which one is. Which one overwhelms you? Okay, I'm seeing a lot of left. Why would you say it's overwhelming for you? Again, just kind of type in your answers there. Too many colors, exactly. So you almost get what's called the picket effect here. So if you think about, in the winter, you're driving down the highway and you're going past a series of trees and it's shade, bright. Well, you're doing this here with color. And here you're actually doing it with three different colors, and not just on the slide bed, but also on the surfacing. So you've got this continual visual overload that's kind of hitting you in the face as you're going down the slides. Landscape structures, Scott Roshi has done a wonderful presentation on color that if you guys haven't done it yet, you should. One of the things he talks about is that primary colors, kids are pretty much done exploring primary colors by the time they're in preschool. So again, just having primary colors, especially in an older kids area or a multi-generational kid area, there's so many different other colors that we can play with. So let me ask you this, which one of these playgrounds is the newer playground, the one on the left or the one on the right? And you can type that in the box. Show you. One on the right went in 2011 and the one on the left went in 2021. So this example is exactly what I hear a lot of designers say is sensory rich. And again, if we're finding it overwhelming as adults, for kids who have developing nervous systems or nervous systems that are already kind of hypersensitive to the world as it is because of their medical condition, this becomes too much on top of all the activity and all the kids. So we really need to, I really actually kind of like the old design. It's a quality slide and it's a nice surfacing and provides all those fun experiences without being overwhelming. All right, so let's jump into the color presentation. Just ask the Habitat team and they can let you know about the color presentation. All right, so let's get to our next slide here. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about a concept of self-regulation. So this is something that a lot of us as occupational therapists and working with a lot of kids with sensory diagnoses focus on. And self-regulation is that ability to kind of manage your own emotions, your own energy state, your behaviors, and pay attention and figure out kind of, am I in a good space? And self-regulation is something that children develop over time. So, 2-year-olds have trouble with self-regulation. That's kind of what the terrible twos are about. When I kind of have that meltdown, my self-regulation is falling apart. I'm not able to hold myself together. And so oftentimes, and preschool teachers in particular are artists in this realm. They are what we call as therapists, good co-regulators. And a co-regulator is somebody who helps that child or helps that individual, kind of coaching them, modeling them, helping them understand how to regulate themselves. So as a therapist, you know, I may get on this piece of equipment with this kiddo who's a little overwhelmed and just kind of rock back and forth with them and help them work on calming themselves down and talk about how sometimes we get overwhelmed. We all do. And what do we do to calm ourselves down? Now, the beauty of this particular piece is it can be used to, to self-regulate by myself or to co-regulate. So it's, you know, it's kind of a win-win there. I can use it as a therapist, or a parent can get on it with a child or another child. Actually, some kids can be very sensitive to other kids' abilities to self-regulate and are great little co-regulators for their peers. They sense that somebody's really struggling and they kind of work with them in a pair like this. Whether it's on something that rocks or something that swings, usually we're looking at something that has some rhythmic movement if they're a bit overwhelmed, as a way to calm themselves. When we think about surfacing, again, this is a population that we need to also think about seamless transitions, because again, there's a motor skill component to some of their diagnoses. A lot of these kids tend to be what we call gravity bound. They have a hard time moving their body up and off the ground. They feel more comfortable on the ground because their proprioception gets more input that way. We also get a lot of feedback from families who have children with autism and other diagnoses within the spectrum to avoid the loose fill, because their children tend to put it in their mouth, or if it has loose edges like the rubber bonded mulch that you see in the picture on the right, their OCD kind of kicks in and they want to pick at it and they want to make it smooth. So anywhere where you have surfacing where there's loose edges, that's annoying to their nervous systems. But we also have this whole group that just aren't safe putting things in their mouth. And so I probably hear more now from parents with children with autism saying, I don't want the engineered wood fiber, than I actually do from families who have children who are wheelchair users. Probably because it's a much larger population who have children with autism. So again, a lot of that seamless transition and unitary surfacing that we look at doing in spaces also has a benefit to this population. Now, one of the things to think about with surfacing color is we need to think about that the color has to make sense with what's happening on the playground. Just to put color, kind of like you saw with that slide, to add color adds a whole other layer of visual complexity, which gets overwhelming. But if you look at the image on the left, everything about this playground is about being the frogs on the mounds or on the lily pads. So they've used the playground grass to define the mounds and the water and the lily pads. And so the kids can go from play element to play element without touching the blue water. The image that you see on the right, which is a little more busy, is actually an indigenous community in the DC area who are using the playground surfacing to tell the story of the river on the Potomac, where they were located, and using fabricated structures that model after their community story. So again, the colors are part of the story. They're part of the play experience. They're not just using color in the surfacing to use color in the surfacing. So being very intentional with that. Also thinking about the fact that tactile play or touch is a full body experience. So what does that surfacing feel like? And so we'll see kids go for different tactile elements as far as even surfacing. So the playground grass does tend to stay a little cooler and have more of a grassy feel than, let's say, a pour in place material does. But things like roller slides and roller tables are definitely a great component to have as well. We want to think about finger play. Finger play can be part of that self-regulation process. So As you see the boy in the image on the left, I've worked with children with autism who will go back to this wall over and over and run their fingers along that rib across the top, and that's part of how they're regulating themselves. Others may be more fascinated by inlaid or more natural elements that you have within the design that are, again, authentic to what the story is of the playground. We want to think about those textures that kids actually could bury themselves in. So thinking about the textures of the sand, we want to think about temperature. Sand at the surface that's dry is has a different feel than the sand that's a little deeper in the box. Or if you actually have your playground in, you know, in a an actual natural water feature like a river or a lake or an ocean, you know, and having that sand element as part of it, you have many different feels to the sand there. But temperature is also something that gets captured by other natural materials as well as man-made materials. But I think kids are much more fascinated with the temperature on natural materials, like this little girl with this bear who kept going back to feel the parts of the bear that were in the shade and the parts of the bear that were in the sun. And we see the same thing also with different types of boulders and elements that we might play. Have on a play space. And then water play. Water also has a texture, and I have a whole other presentation I do on inclusive water play where I talk about the feel of the water. Water can feel gentle, it can feel prickly, it can feel like a massive amount of weight when it comes out of a dumping element. So what's the feel of that water? And that's all controlled by the different levels of pressure that are used within that element. When we get into climbing, again, we need to start by doing ground play first. Many of these children are still struggling with their motor coordination. Many of them need to feel attached to the earth to work on those motor patterns. So here we're just using, you know, a hillside that has some handholds and footholds so kids can get used to doing those motor patterns and using those play elements. You can then move that onto a more vertical surface and take that into a climbing structure. So you're using the same handholds and footholds, but it's solid. And then you move into netted material or a blend of those where we have much more movement that's much more challenging to their motor systems to be able to navigate across a full net structure that not only do I have to respond to my own movement within the net, but I've got to adjust my body posture to somebody else who might be climbing in there too. We want to think about the directions that children climb, not just up and down, but side to side, in diagonal ways, again, starting with maybe elements that are more solid, so I can get those motor patterns down, and then moving into, again, netted elements, and then lateral movement. So lateral movement is important because it helps kids work both sides of their brain and get both sides of the brain talking with each other, getting them to cross midline is a huge element that happens on these type of play elements, and that's really important for being able to do reading and writing and feeding into some of these different skills that kids may be struggling with some of these diagnoses. We do want to have overhead elements so that kids can work on those upper body. Again, here, you know, we have full bars across so they can work one hand to the next hand, so they lead with the right, bring the left to it, lead with the right, bring the left to it, or they can go into reciprocal where they actually have to alternate hands. That's a more complex motor pattern that you're going to see as kids get older, that ability to alternate left, right, as opposed to bringing the second hand to the lead hand. And then swinging. This is definitely one of the elements that kids with a lot of sensory diagnoses will use to get out there and work on calming themselves. And so most children just love to swing, but it's that rhythmic movement. So you want to make sure that you have swings that allow for kind of that co-regulation. So anything that allows kids to be together. And then self-regulation, that ability to also use that swing for my own calming down. And every once in a while we catch a kiddo who self-regulates right to sleep. When we think about rotation, this is a little more complex for the vestibular system. So swinging and rocking and things like that are very linear. That's the simplest. Self-rotation is I'm rotating around an axis like this little girl is. Again, we can co-regulate to do that together. You can also integrate it into social play. So taking it into bigger elements that allow kids to be together as they rotate. And then you can also do spinning. So spinning is the most complex. That means that the axis is going right up through the axis of my body. And co-regulation can happen with somebody helping me spin, as we see in the picture on the left. Or we can spin side by side. And again, you know, perfect picture for this because they're dressed the same. They're doing the same thing. They are individually spinning, but they are actually kind of mirroring each other and may actually be using that spinning for co-regulation and then also for self-regulation. So that ability to use spinning to kind of really wake my nervous system up. This is actually something we see a lot of kids with Down syndrome do because their overall muscle tone is low, and spinning actually really wakes up their nervous system and tightens, makes that muscle tone tighter so that they can then go over and climb and do something that's working on a motor skill. And then as that muscle tone begins to decay again, they come back and spin. So I've seen a lot of kiddos with Down syndrome go kind of back and forth from spinners to climbers, spinners to climbers, spinners to climbers, almost like they're winding themselves up on the spinner. They go climb, they come back, they wind themselves up again, but they're working on that motor skill while they're playing. And then having visual exploration. So for some of these kiddos, they're uncomfortable with direct eye contact. So having elements that they can play through, like a panel, but also looking at the exploration of water and that ability to use water as a way to play. I'm going to share a little story here from a 10-year-old who has, he told me he has Asperger's. He said, I can share this story with you. I can't tell you his name, but I can tell you he had Asperger's. And I was at a big playground with an OT student, and we were taking a little break, and we were sitting on the swings, and him and his buddy were on the swings next to us. And they proceeded to look at us and say, you know, like, you're grown-ups. You're not supposed to be on the swings. And I said, well, you're like 10. What are you doing on the swings? And he said, well, these are the best swings in the world. And he was just on a simple belt swing. So I was like, okay, well, what makes these the best swings in the world? And he said, well, because at this playground, I can choose to look at that beautiful park and that beautiful river over there, and I don't have to look at that really crazy playground behind me. And this is the only park in the neighborhood where I can do that. Every other park I go to, I have to look at a parking lot or a street or a playground. And none of those things make me feel calm. But looking at this nice river here makes me feel calm. And so, you know, that was kind of an aha moment for me. It made me kind of stop and think, you know, oftentimes swings are on the outer sides of playgrounds because they need space. And what do we make people look at when they're swinging? Like, do we make them look at really crazy, busy stuff? You know, like the playground was visually too much for him. He needed to look at something that was calming. And we know the research shows that when we're looking at natural environments, our physiology calms down. I mean, at 10, he knew this. So every time I look at a playground design now, I look at it differently, thanks to Mr. Asperger's. So something to think about when we're designing. I want to just show you briefly, this is just a quick video, there's no auditory with it, but this is a great feature to have within a water feature for three reasons. First of all, visually, it completely blurs what he's looking at. So if he's overwhelmed visually with all the other kids playing, he loses that. Auditorily, the water is also dampening all the sound of the other kids around him. And then tactily, he's feeling this sheet of water. So all three of those tend to be ways to calm the nervous system. And so to have some type of element like this within a splash pad can be a huge resource for some of those kiddos with some of these diagnoses, to give them that ability to self-regulate within kind of that busy environment. And then when we look at music, we want to look at what are ways where we can experience music together, again, working on some of that co-regulation. And then also that ability to then graduate and use that for my own calming. So whether it's a tone that helps me calm down, and I'll show you an example in the case study right at the end of how we integrated some sound into kind of a regulation process of leaving the playground. We want to think about our plantings to allow children to engage in natural elements as well as gardening type spaces, so that children can be part of that process of planting and digging and tasting and smelling and watching our world and our food evolve. And then finally, to get into the concepts of helping us stay there. Here we're going to look at how do we define containment, what are some of those amenities, the importance of shade, the importance of communication, quiet spaces, and then layout. And then I'm going to finish with a case study of how we laid this into a design. So let's start with probably the most or the biggest aha moment I had putting this presentation together. I can't tell you how many parents I have talked to who have children on the spectrums who say, please, 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 please fence in the playground. And so the research shows that nearly half of children with autism, especially when they get overwhelmed, tend to bolt away from safety. Some of them just wander off, but many will bolt. And drowning remains the leading cause of death for children with autism, accounting for almost 90% of those deaths for those kiddos. That's really mind-blowing, and it really, I think, you know, made me really stop and think about what these parents are saying. My goal as a therapist, if I'm working on a playground design with somebody, is I don't want that child to get to the point where they have to feel like they have to flee, that they get overwhelmed. We should be able to create a layout in such a way that they can go find those places to self-regulate. But the reality is some of them will wander off, some of them will bolt, and we need to think about how do we contain these spaces, because these families are going to continue to come to us with that request. So I have a couple examples here, one that's local for you guys up in BC, of how can we take just something as simple as a chain link fence and add a component to it that actually has a sensory way for children to self-regulate. And I love this program, Fishes on Fences, where the Stream of Dreams organization comes in and it teaches children the life cycle of the salmon and how important the water flow is. And every kid gets to decorate their own fish, and it goes on the fence. And so when that child begins to flee, they are fleeing to something that has a visual, tactile component to it that can actually be used for self-regulation. So how do we integrate those type of opportunities? This is like a perfect win-win. It's an educational opportunity, it's supporting a nonprofit mission, and it's also supporting the sensory needs for our kiddos. Here's another example. This is from Milwaukee. This was, again, a fence that was actually put up around a building that was being renovated, and they partnered with, again, another nonprofit from the art district, and all the kids got the chance to create one of these medallions and put some type of positive message on it, and then they were glazed in this color palette and just tied by little wires onto the fence. And so, again, you've got this tactile, visual play that comes from this design. And then when the school was reopened, these were actually integrated into the wall of the school inside the building, which was a really cool way to finish it off. But you know, we can be very creative with how we create containment. It doesn't have to be just a boring fence, and there could be some really interesting collaborating partners out there that can help us create a way of making this space a purposeful space where children can actually work on self-regulation or co-regulation. We want to think about our amenities. We want to keep those close to the actual playground. How close are my shelters? How close are my restrooms? We want to think about that access for all, but we want to keep that line of sight for parents as well, since some of these kiddos do tend to wander. We want to think about our restrooms from that standpoint of access. kind of get mixed messages on the push bars, because sometimes parents will say, well, that allows my kid to get out before I'm ready for them to leave. You can also do the interior push lock, so that, you know, you have to do two buttons. You see that at some of the airports too. And you do want to also think about an adult or a universal changing bench within the restroom. So a bench that could go along the back wall that somebody can lay down on and change. Again, some of these kiddos do have toileting issues, especially some of those on the autism, with autism in particular. If this is something you're interested in, I have a couple designs I've put together for family bathrooms that I can send to you. That you can integrate into your designs. Just work with your local architect to make sure the measurements all work for whatever the amenity is you're designing as far as the bathrooms. We want to make sure that we have integrated shade as much as possible. Where we can use natural shade is obviously the biggest plus, because you get the filtered light, you get the changing of the color of the leaves, you get the sound of the wind going through the leaves. I know the maintenance folks always have an issue with it at the end, you know, when the leaves come down. But, you know, trees naturally cool the environment around them. It's a little different than using the integrated man-made shade, which definitely also can be very playful and provide at least some protection from direct sunlight, but it doesn't cool the environment the same way that trees do. Then we want to look at communication systems, and the research shows that about 40% of those with autism are nonverbal, and they will use some type of communication system. It may be what's called the picture exchange communication system. It might be a combination of sign language. Some kids will actually spell out their preferences depending on how they've been taught, what they're able to learn, and what works most effectively for them. So we created this communication board a couple years ago in partnership with a couple speech therapists to integrate kind of that combination. The colors are also important as far as identifying nouns and verbs and things like that. So, you know, again, a great addition to the playground. And then we want to make sure that there's also these quiet spaces where kids can kind of check themselves in to work on that self-regulation. And that can be done, first of all, beautifully with different types of natural plantings, just creating little sensory huts out of willows and such. For many kids, you know, they think they've disappeared when they're behind that bush or that little collection of bushes you've put together. And unless they're wearing camouflage, parents are still going to be able to see them. But, you know, this little girl thinks like, I've pretty much disappeared. You know, come find me. And even for older kids, that ability to get up into the trees and get into that vegetation can be a great self-regulation benefit. And again, the fascination that comes from the different sensory elements of all those natural elements. You can also build some of those quiet spaces into actual structures as well. So kind of nooks and crannies, maybe under a structure or within the structure. The Cozy Dome is designed as a self-regulation space. It's also a great climber for a lot of kids, but for a lot of our kids with sensory elements, they like to, or sensory diagnoses, they like to go inside and kind of, you know, peek out at the world around them, but be able to re-regulate themselves. And then also, they're just great places for reflection, for kids to be able to just stop and take a breather during play and to think about what they've done or what they want to do next. Just enjoy being where they're at. So just a quick layout explanation too. So this is a playground up in North Dakota. We have some active places, and those are going to be more your structures and maybe your group swings and your group spinner type things. We have some quieter play that's interlaced between that. So some of them are things that are rocking, music, Cozy Dome there in the middle, and then also some quiet co-regulation type spaces where I can swing together, I can rock up and back and forth together, and we can zip together and kind of work on that regulation together. So what I want to do to kind of finish off is take you through a case study of a playground that I've been designing with a team in Iowa. This playground is actually right now, I think, going into the ground. So I'm excited to kind of see it this summer. So this gives you kind of a sense of the actual playground space. Up above is all the parking. Off to the right is probably about 6 or 7 ball fields. To the left is an open nature area. And then down to the bottom is the Raccoon River. Probably still a good distance from the playground. The playground is kind of elevated, and then there's a slope that takes you down to the river. And so within this, we've got our parking and public access coming from the top. We have two main entry points, and we actually pulled in the Art Council in this community into helping us define what those entry points are going to look like. So these are going to be kind of sensory-rich archways that tell the story of... that get you up high in Area 6. And then we've got a blend of different sensory play. So in Area 2, this is a sensory path, which actually takes us to our ramped access to the slide, which is in Area 3 on the hillside there. Area 4 is actually a music collection, which is right where you enter or exit up on that side, kind of from the early childhood area. So Area 2 and 4 are also designed to be areas for transitioning, for leaving, that have a sensory calming effect. So either playing with the music instruments or going through kind of the grove there in Area 2, which will have some tactile play within it. There's also some tactile play in Area 10. Area 13 is actually where there's areas for eating and picnic tables. And then Area 7 and 12 are more of the quiet sensory area. So this is a rendering of the vestibular play, for more so for the older kids. Notice the bucket seats are facing towards the river, which would be off kind of on your bottom right. And then this gives you the sense coming from the parking lot. So you can see the mounded type climbing play, the early childhood play, which does have some integrated shade above, and then the bigger climbers in the middle. This is a different angle of the same areas. And then we wanted to make sure that there were concepts that the important things to help people stay there. So containment is being done with a combination of plantings and integrated fencing into the plantings, so that really you're not going to be able to see the fencing because of the plant life that's being put in there, that creates kind of cozy places but protects kids from getting into kind of those main parking areas. Communication board, we have just added a second one up by Area 4 as well, since those are the two main areas where families are going to come in. We're debating whether to put one also coming off the shelters or not. That will be up to the park if they want to do that. We have the natural shade in Areas 2, and then down at the area next to 12. And then we have some man-made shade that's also integrated into that early childhood area. We have quiet spaces again within the different areas as well. So Area 2 that I spoke about, coming off of the eating area, and then the sensory area that focuses down towards the river, that Area 7 and 12. So this was an early rendering of that sensory area. I don't have the latest, but the Art Council is going to do sensory play in this area with an integrated wall to the tune of about $75,000. So they're looking at doing a full community engagement to create a series of mosaics, and there'll be a whole sensory wall in that area that's going to be really cool to see. So you can see, once the playground is up and open, we're going to work on the website to make sure people understand all the new elements there in the new playground. Definitely the concepts to playing there are there, as far as the different types of diverse sensory play, and then having those pieces that allow people to stay there, those amenities, and that ability to tap into all the other things that are happening in the park. And that wraps us up for my portion. I'm open for questions. I am going to, for the CEU folks, hopefully, yeah, the link is still there. That's the link. If you do need the CEUs, just click on that link in the chat box. And hang on, let me make sure this goes to everybody. All right, that should have gone to everybody. So if you didn't get the CEU link at the beginning, if you click on that, you should be able to interface with the web-based CEU form so that Landscape Structures and Habitat can get you your CEUs. So I'm open for questions, comments. If there's anything that kind of struck you or anything that you want to chat more about, we've got about 15 minutes. I know this is a little longer than some of the other ones. Or I'll be back tomorrow and we're going to talk about universal design tomorrow.
Ingrid, that was fantastic. Thank you so much. If anyone has any questions, please feel free to reach out to one of your Habitat team members, and we'd be more than happy to answer any questions you have. But thank you so much, Ingrid.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Recording stopped.
Ingrid Canix.
So I'm finished unless, you know, I'm not seeing anybody popping any questions up. So again, I thank you for your time and I wish you a good rest of the day since you still have a little bit to go.
Thank you, Ingrid. And we'll see you online tomorrow and hopefully some others as well.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Have a good afternoon, everybody.
All righty.
Bye, thanks.
Bye-bye. Amazing. So that was really cool. I love to see that kind of community investment and public engagement, mosaics, really thoughtful investment in shared public spaces and parks, and focused around kids and special needs and learning. Thanks so much for listening. This is the Green Antler Podcast. And my name is Sarah Fowler with the Waterfowl. Bye-bye.